On November 27th, in the year 1095, Pope Urban II announced a crusade in the French city of Clermont to liberate the holy city of Jerusalem from the infidel Muslims. For all kinds of reasons, the end of the 11th century was deemed the appropriate time for Christendom to make every effort to recapture the city of Jerusalem and bring it once again under Christian control. It had been under Muslim control already for centuries, but enough is enough, and now's the time for Christians to be able to assert their authority over this most holy city for Christendom. I invite you to look at source number one, which is a map, which shows the route of the Crusaders to the Holy Land and the places where they stopped along the way. You see Clermont in the bottom, the left side in France. And then as we move our way eastward, just take a little detour and look north where it says Germany to Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. We're going to be spending pretty much the entire session today on this area, this geographical area. And then we continue to move eastward and we end up in Jerusalem, which is in the bottom right, in the year 1099. So there was a response to the call of the Pope, and the Crusaders mobilized, and it took them some 3 years to make their way all the way across to Jerusalem. They succeeded in conquering Jerusalem from the Muslims in 1099. It remained under Christian control for a little bit over 100 years. Went back to Muslim control, remained the city of Jerusalem in under Muslim control until the year 1917. So for a very, very long period of time, from somewhere towards the beginning of the 7th century until 1099, from somewhere around 1215 to 1917, Jerusalem is under Muslim control. In 1917, it is given over to the British as a British mandate. And of course, in 1948, it becomes the capital of the State of Israel. The Crusaders left and made their way to Jerusalem, but they quickly realized, why do I have to wait until I get to the city of Jerusalem to kill infidels if I can kill infidels right here in my backyard? And the kind of infidels that we're talking about in the backyard are real infidels. The relationship between Christianity and Judaism is very different than the relationship between Christianity and Islam. Jews, after all, were guilty of deicide. Jews were responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus. If Jews killed God, then Jews need to be punished. Jews clearly are evil and need to be the subject of persecution. So I might as well, right here, start the job before I get in 3.5 years from now to the city of Jerusalem. As soon as the Crusades were announced, French Jewry became very frightened. The Crusade was announced in France. They knew what was going to happen. They were very concerned. And they sought assistance from their co-religionists in Germany. Turn to text number two. We have a number of chronicles that describe the events that occurred in Europe as the Crusaders were making their way eastward to the Holy City. This one happens to be known as Mainz Anonymous. Second paragraph, they said to each other, this is the Christians said to one another, look now, we are going to a distant country to make war against mighty kings and are endangering our lives to conquer the kingdoms which do not believe in the crucified one. Islam doesn't believe in Jesus. You understand that these are languages that are placed into the mouths of the Christians by the Jews. The Christians wouldn't refer to Jesus this way. There's a pejorative sense here. But the essence is clear. The Christians are saying, why do I have to go all the way over there in order to act out against those who are not believing in Jesus, when actually it is the Jews who murdered and crucified him. They're much more guilty, and they happen to be much closer. They stirred up hatred against us in all quarters and declared that either we should accept their abominable faith or else they would annihilate us all, even infants and sucklings. They gave us a choice. If you want, you could convert to Christianity. If you're not going to convert to Christianity, then we're going to kill you. The noblemen and common people placed an evil symbol, namely a vertical line over a horizontal one, the sign of the cross, on their garments and special hats on their heads. And so they're turning now against the Jews. The Jews get nervous. The ones who were closest to where this began get nervous. When the communities in the land of France heard this, they were gripped by fear and trembling, and they resorted to the custom of their ancestors. That is a traditional phrase in rabbinical literature, that they did what the previous generations did when they were confronted with potential danger. So they tried to bribe, and they tried to pray, and they tried to prepare themselves to somehow stave off the terrible edict. They wrote letters and dispatched messengers to all communities around the River Rhine, bidding them to proclaim fast days and seek mercy from God that he might save them from the hands of the enemy. Notice fast days. I mentioned in an earlier presentation that fast days played a number of different roles in Jewish tradition. One of them was to stave off a potentially impending tragedy. Something terrible might happen. In the classic rabbinic context, it's a drought, and oh my God, we may not have enough food, and what are we going to do? And so a fast day is established to enable Jews to look at one another, look into themselves, introspection, to try to make themselves better, to try to elevate themselves, to try to repent, to try to get rid of sins, and hopefully in response to their desire to self-improve, God will remove the potential disaster. So here they asked the German Jews, those on the Rhine River, to proclaim fast days on their behalf to beseech God for mercy. When the letters reached the saints, the men of renown, the pillars of the universe in Mainz — Mainz is one of the cities, and I showed it to you earlier on the map, one of the major cities in the Rhine Valley that was a very significant Jewish community that had very significant Jewish rabbinic leadership. There was an academy, a yeshiva there. It was very well renowned for its scholarship. When the leadership of the community in Mainz got the letter, they wrote to the land of France saying the following. So we don't have the letter of the Jews of France to Germany. We don't have the original letter of the Jews of Germany back to France, but we have a synopsis of that letter. And there's actually a quote, but there's no quote in the original Hebrew. But this is essentially what the response was from Germany back to France. We did what you wanted. All the communities have decreed a fast day. We have done our duty. May the omnipresent one save us and you from all the trouble and affliction. We are greatly concerned about your well-being. But as for ourselves here in Germany, there is no great cause for fear. We have not heard a word of such matters, nor has it been hinted that our lives are threatened by the sword. In a colossal expression of what would prove to be radical naivete, the leaders of German Jewry say, we feel for you, we care about you, we're praying for you, we're doing whatever we can for you. But as far as we're concerned, we're fine. It's going to be okay here. We have no idea what you're talking about. We haven't heard anything. We're okay in Germany, and we'll do whatever we can because you asked us and we care about you and you're our core religionists who live in France. Now, just for a moment, it's interesting to look back in retrospect, because what happens is that French Jewry emerges relatively unscathed from the entire story of the Crusades, and German Jewry gets absolutely hammered. And you begin to ask yourself, in retrospect, what were they thinking? Now, in hindsight, it's always easy to ask the question. And a lot of research has been done to try to figure out what was going on in the 11th century in Germany that allow German Jews to think that this is not an issue for them and it's not going to happen to them. And we have a number of historical analogies, and they're pretty obvious. I'll take one that may be less obvious, and that is the Spanish expulsion in 1492. Like, how did that happen? What were the Jews thinking about before the Spanish expulsion? Did they have a sense that they were in trouble 20, 30, 40 years before the Spanish expulsion? And we're going to be spending significant time on that in session number 5. And of course, the most obvious one in the 20th century is German Jewry before the Holocaust. So in retrospect, what are you thinking? Easy to say, but it's a very painful question. And one wonders, when one looks back at events that end up to be terrible, to look back at what's going on beforehand and to try to understand the mindset. These people are not suicidal. These people have thoughts and understanding and perspective and wisdom. So how do you understand what was going on before the Shoah in Germany, before the Spanish expulsion in Spain, and before the First Crusade way back when in 11th century Germany? A few months later, in the spring of 1096, the Crusaders move out of France, and as you see on the map, they take a detour. If you look at the map, you notice that there's a direct line from southern France to Jerusalem, and that line does not necessarily require one to make a detour and go all the way up into Speyer, Worms, and Mainz in the Rhine Valley in Germany. But knowing that these were very significant Jewish communities, and knowing that it's going to be a lot quicker to go there than it will be to Jerusalem, and knowing that the Jews are the ones who are really the infidels, they are the ones who are responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus, of deicide. So, time well spent, we're on a roll, let's go and take care of the Jewish community. They attacked and destroyed, particularly, not exclusively, there were some 20 communities in the area of Germany that were destroyed by the Crusades, particularly the cities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. Speyer, Worms, and Mainz are all along the Rhine River in the Rhine Valley, going from south to north. One can travel there today. I've been there maybe 4 or 5 times. It's about 45 minutes to an hour from Speyer to Worms and from Worms to Mainz. And one can see, particularly in Worms, less so in Speyer and even less so in Mainz, evidence of medieval Jewish communities. This story, the story of the destruction wrought by the Crusades, is told in a number of chronicles and also in a number of liturgical poems that were written to commemorate the events and that were some inserted into the prayer book to be recited on different occasions. Let's look now at source number 3, the Chronicle of Solomon bar Simson, Shlomo bar Shimshon, and let's turn to the bottom left of page 22. This comes from Professor Eidelberg, Shlomo Eidelberg, who published an English translation of the Crusade Chronicles, and we have here the text that I'd like to draw your attention to. In the chronicle, we have an exact description, a precise historical description of what happened. We have names of places, we have dates of attack, and we have also, on some occasions, number of Jews who were killed. That year, Passover fell on a Thursday. And the new moon of the following month, Iyar, the month on which Passover falls, is the month of Nisan. The next month is Iyar. The first day, the new moon, in Hebrew, Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the new month of Iyar, fell on a Friday and on Shabbat, on the Sabbath. On the 8th day of Iyar, if day 1 is the Sabbath, then day 8 is going to be the Sabbath. On the eighth day of Iyar, on the Sabbath, the foe attacked the community of Spire and murdered 11 holy souls who sanctified their creator on the holy Sabbath and refused to defile themselves by adopting the faith of their foe. Remember, the option was granted them. You could save yourself if you converted to Christianity. They refused to do so. And starting south to north, Spire is the southernmost of these three cities. Jews are killed on the eighth day of Iyar, 11 holy souls. There was a distinguished pious woman there who slaughtered herself in sanctification of God's name. We see repeatedly in the Crusade Chronicles that not only did they allow themselves to be killed, but sometimes they actually even committed suicide, killing themselves, and sometimes even, parenthesis, in an act or series of acts that aroused great questioning by not so much contemporaries, but later on, they actually murdered one another in order not to allow anybody to, God forbid, fall into the hands of the Crusaders, because God forbid, in a weak moment, somebody may convert, and therefore we have to stop this from happening. This paroxysm of self-immolation is shocking to the modern ear and is very much a part of the story of what happened during the Crusades. On the 23rd of Iyar, they attacked a community of worms. So we have the 8th of Iyar, and then some 2 weeks later, they're moving north. I mentioned before it takes 45 minutes to an hour by bus or by car. So it took them a little bit longer to make their way north up the river. And on the 23rd of the month of Iyar, they attacked a community of worms. The community was then divided into two groups. Worms was a much larger community than was the community of Spire. Some remained in their homes and others fled to the local bishop seeking refuge. Stop for a second. Interesting. The local bishop was interested in protecting the Jews. We shouldn't have this simplistic notion that it's always Jews against Christians and that the Christians hated the Jews and wanted to destroy the Jews, all of them, and the Jews hated the Christians and wanted to destroy the Christians or get rid of them as much as they possibly could. It's much more complex than that. In this case, the bishop in Worms was interested in protecting the Jews, and they found refuge in his quarters. Those who remained in their homes were set upon by the steppe wolves, who pillaged men, women, infants, children, old people. They pulled down the stairways, destroyed the houses, they looted, they plundered, they took the Torah scroll, trampled it in the mud, tore and burned it. Understand very well, this is not just from the perspective of Christianity a desire to kill Jews, but it's a desire to eradicate Judaism. And so anything that represented holiness in the Jewish context was for them anathema. And so they didn't want to just kill Jews and punish Jews because the Jews killed Jesus, but they wanted to destroy any vestige of holiness in Judaism. So they went after not only Jews, but also after the Torah. The enemy devoured the children of Israel. 7 days later, on the new moon of Sivan, now it's Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the month of Sivan, that's the next month, the third month in the Hebrew calendar. The very day on which the children of Israel arrived at Mount Sinai to receive the Torah, our tradition tells us that it was on the first day of the month of Sivan when Jews arrived in the area around Mount Sinai, when they were prepared a couple of days later to receive the Torah from God, from Moses, the revelation at Sinai. You understand the contrast here, that on a day what was so special and holy and precious and substantial and significant now becomes a day of destruction and persecution. Those Jews who were still in the court of the bishop were subjected to great anguish. So what happened in Worms, well, there were 2 days where the Jewish community was destroyed in Worms. In Spire, it's on the eighth day of Iyar. In Worms, it's on the 23rd of Iyar, and a week later on the first day of the month of Sivan. Skip to the next paragraph. We talk here about Mainz, when the saints, the pious ones of the Most High, the holy community of Mainz. And then skip to the page 29, a continuation. It's text number 4, but it's a continuation on page 29. There's a long description about Mainz. And when we get to Mainz, in the first full paragraph on page 29, on the third day of Sivan, once again, in ancient times, in biblical times, the third day of Sivan was particularly holy, precious, and significant because it was counting down to the revelation at Sinai. On that very day, the community of Mainz, saints of the Most High, withdrew from each other in sanctity and purity, sanctified themselves to ascend to God altogether. And so we have in this chronicle and in other chronicles, and we'll see shortly in a liturgical poem, clear historical evidence of exactly what happened, exactly where it happened, and exactly the days on which it happened. This is going to be extremely significant and very important to us, as you will see shortly. Let's review. South to north, big, big, huge left turn on the way from southern France to the Holy Land. We're going to now direct our attentions on the way to the real infidels. We're going to go to a place, a cluster of cities where Jews were very prominent, very significant Jewish communities. Going from south to north, they're coming from south. So they hit Shpaya first, eighth day of Iyar. And here we actually have a number. There were 11 Jews. Then we come to Worms. Worms, the number are pretty much over 1,000. It's not mentioned here in this text, over 1,000 Jews. But in Worms, there was a double destruction, 23rd of Iyar, first day of Sivan. And then just 3 days later, they make their way to the next town, north, Mainz, and there is the destruction of the Jewish community of Mainz. Now, in addition to the Crusade Chronicles, and I read one with you in significant detail, there were also elegies, or what we call keynote, that were written to commemorate the tragedy. Several of them were written by a poem by the name of Kalonymus, the son of Yehuda. And you'll remember Kalonymus because I'm going to be repeating this name repeatedly in the rest of this lecture series. One of them poetically laments the terrible pain and suffering experienced by the victims. In general terms, highlights the extraordinary faith and voluntary martyrdom of the victims, accepts the justness of God's decree, even though it was so horrific and unbearably hurtful, and goes so far as to call for vengeance, asks God to avenge the death, the blood that was shed by these victims. This general kind of a content for a kina, or a elegy, written in the aftermath of calamity and suffering, is pretty standard. Generally, these kinds of liturgical poems that are composed to be recited in reaction to particular persecutions or tragedies have only one interest. And that interest is totally theological and absolutely not historical. Their interest is not to tell the story. They're not at all interested in this happened and that happened and this happened here and this is how many people and then they went here and then they did this. That is of absolute no interest to them. Professor Yerushalmi, in the book that I mentioned in the first presentation, Zachor, subtitled Jewish History and Jewish Memory, makes the point that Jews, pretty much more or less, were not historians. We did a lot when it came to contributing to all kinds of genre in medieval Europe and medieval world. We did poems, we wrote poetry, we wrote commentaries on the Bible, we wrote commentaries on the Talmud. We participated significantly in all kinds of writing, but history was not of great interest to us. And these kinds of poems were only interested in one question. And the question was, oh my God, how are we going to be able to strengthen Jewish faith in the face of such tremendous challenge to Jewish faith? It's only natural that a survivor who experienced this horror is going to ask, and here again, 20th century analogies are foremost in our minds, why did God do this to us? How could God do this to us? Does God still have a special relationship with us, it sure doesn't look like God has a special relationship with us. And so these liturgical poems are written to help shore up potentially wavering faith in God. Yes, God does love you. God still cares about you. God still has a relationship with you, you individually, and us as a Jewish people, even though I don't get it, even though on the face of it, it seems the opposite. And in order to do so, they utilize forms. They utilize elusive, hyperbolic language, describing God, the Jewish people, in archetypal and transtemporal ways. They're timeless, they're not time-bound, they're general, they're not specific. I want to give you strength to recognize that God still cares about you. That's their interest. And it's a tall order because the challenge is enormous. Even in the medieval world, where the connection between the Jewish people and God was much stronger and much more primal than it is today. That was the basic assumption. But now it's potentially being shattered for pretty good reasons. So now we have a job to do. We can't let that happen. We need Jews somehow, in spite of all of this, to be able to have faith in God. And so we write poetry to give them the strength, to give them the perspective, to somehow heal them, to somehow enable them to continue to have and to feel, have a relationship with God and to feel the presence of God in their lives. God did not sever the bond of God's covenantal relationship with you personally or with the Jewish people. And so a historian whose interest is in facts, in history, is challenged to mine factual, historical nuggets out of these various poems. Now, a historian who wants to know what the Jews were thinking about has a great deal of material. That's exactly what this is about. But if you want to know what happened, you're not going to find what happened, because there is no focus on the facts of what happened. It's just a larger question. So much so that we find this propensity in later generations when a tragedy happens, and this is explicitly indicated. You know what? I don't have to even write a new liturgical poem to try to deal with this tragedy. I'm just going to dust off one from 600 years ago, and I'm going to say that now, because the issue is the same. What happened 600 years ago looks like God is gone. Well, now it looks like God is gone. Well, I have already something in place to deal with, oh my God, God is gone. So I'm going to pick it up and plunk it down, and that's what I'm going to say. Because the issue is God is gone. The particular context of that issue doesn't really matter. And so we find repeatedly reusing hundreds of years ago texts that we're now going to insert into the prayer book to be recited on a penitential service that is going to be established for this commemoration of this particular tragedy. Well, we're going to go way back there and we're going to use the same one, because the goal is exactly the same, because the challenge is exactly the same. And so the way to deal with that challenge is exactly the same. But every once in a while, we have a poetic elegy that surprises us, that is actually highly unusual. One that does focus specifically on the facts, on the place, on the date, tells us explicitly what happened. And it is to this elegy, written by Colonimus, that I want to draw your attention in text number 5. This is an elegy that was written by Colonimus in commemoration of the destruction of the, what is known as the triple community of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. In Hebrew, Speyer is Shin, begins with a Shin. Worms in Hebrew is Vermeisa, begins with a Vav. Mainz, Mem, Magenza. So if you take the first letters of each, Shin, Speyer, Vav, Vermeisa, Worms, Mem, Magenza, Kihilot, Shum. There's an acronym, Shin, Vav, Mem. They're known as the triple community of Shum, of Speyer, Vermeisa, and Magenza. He writes, an elegy to commemorate the destruction, and he writes it to be recited on the fast day of the ninth of Av, which in my previous session, I pointed out, was instituted to commemorate the destruction of the first temple and the second temple. So now, on the ninth of Av, we are going to say something that is going to commemorate the persecution of the Crusades. Let's take a look at this text. Text number 5. Verily my eyelids, page 133 in this verse, and on the right side. Verily my eyelids gush with water, and my eyes stream with tears. Okay, so this is not a history book. This is a poem. So he's emotion here. He's terrible. He's crying. It's awful. As I bewail in bitterness of soul, the martyrs of Speyer. So now we have a place. It happened on the eighth day in the second month, on the eighth day of Iyar, on the day of rest. What's the day of rest? On Shabbat. Well, we know from the previous text. Speyer, eighth day of Iyar, and Shabbat. Next paragraph. In the bitterness of my anguish and my sorrow, I indite dirges as I call to mind this day and the martyrdom of the holy congregations, the congregation of Worms. Next one, up the river. Well tested and chosen, the renowned ones of the land, perfect in purity. Twice did they sanctify the unity of God in awe. Twice. Once on the 23rd of the month of Iyar. Another way of referring to Iyar is Chodesh Ziv. It means the second month, Chodesh Iyar, the month of Iyar. And the second time, in the third month of Sivan, during the reading and chanting of the Hallel, which is a prayer recited on the first day of the month. And so again, second city, this time Worms. Here it is again, twice in Worms, place and dates. When was it twice? 23rd of Iyar and the first of Sivan. Next paragraph, for the noble ones of the esteemed congregation of Mainz. So it's spelled either M-A-Y-E-N-C-E or it's spelled M-A-I-N-Z. It's the same city. In Hebrew, it's known as Magenza, who was swifter than eagles and stronger than lions. Next paragraph. On the third day of the third month of Sivan, they were destroyed. So here we have an elegy, an unusual elegy, an uncommon kind of an elegy, one that is not just devoted to these transtemporal, timeless themes of restoring a potentially shattered paradigm of a relationship between the Jewish people and God, but one that is historical, factual, practical, this city, this date, then this city, two dates, then this city, this date. And then, next page, continue text number 5, he says the following, and he addresses a very obvious question. The question is, why am I talking about this today? What is today? When is this meant to be recited? And parenthesis, in fact, is recited in traditional communities on the ninth day of Av. It's included in the textbook, in the book, the prayer book that's recited on the ninth day of Av. Why? What am I doing? What am I talking about it today? I just told you it didn't happen today. I just told you it happened a couple of months ago. I told you exactly when it happened. I told you it happened on the eighth day of Iyar in Speyer, on the 23rd day of Iyar in Worms, on the first day of Sivan in Worms, on the third day of Sivan in Mainz. So what am I doing today? Why am I mentioning it? Paragraph, top of the page. Take this to your hearts and prepare a sad funeral oration. Put on mourning and roll in the dust. Now he's back to his poetic imagery. For their massacre, the massacre of the Jews of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, weighs no less than the burning of the house of God, its porch, and its palace. That's amazing. It is equivalent in its awfulness to the destruction of the temple. This is as bad as the destruction of the temple. The Hebrew here is shikula harigatam. Shakul means equivalent, equal. This is as bad as the destruction of the temple, which means it's really bad. The destruction of the temple is sort of the paradigmatic event that is like the worst. The ninth of Av is the most intense fast day. It's the worst thing, and not just one temple, two temples. You should know that what happened in Germany at the end of the 11th century is equivalent in its horribleness to what happened when the temple was destroyed. And then he continues, and since we may not add an extra season of mourning for destruction and conflagration, skip a line, therefore will I cause my cry of woe to rise today, and I will wail, howl, and weep in bitterness of soul. If this is as bad as the destruction of the temple, why don't I mourn it on a day appropriate to it, like I mourn on a day appropriate to the destruction of the temple? And lo and behold, 2.5 minutes ago, 12 lines ago, I told you exactly when. So you'll choose. So you'll choose the date of the 8th of Iyar. That's when it began. You'll choose the 23rd of Iyar or the 1st of Sivan, because Worms was the most prominent community. You'll choose the last one. You'll choose the 3rd of Sivan from Mainz. Why don't I mourn then? Why don't I have a fast day then? And you just told me how significant this is. This is a day equal in its solemnity and severity and disaster to the destruction of the temple. And so he tells us, we don't do that. We don't do that. Look at the language again. It's extremely important. We don't add new days, since we may not add an extra time for mourning. So we're going to do it today. You're right. You're right. We should. Makes sense if we would. After all, it's equal to the temple. After all, it happened on a different day. But we don't do that. We just don't do that. The destruction of the temple is so significant and so repercussive and has such a massive impact, then the commemoration of subsequent catastrophes, even great ones, and even those who may be equivalent to the destruction of the temple, and even those that we know happened on a different day than the day of the destruction of the temple, need to be, here comes the word again, subsumed under the commemoration of the destruction of the temple. Now let's stop for a moment and appreciate the significance of this. We saw in the second presentation that the rabbis in the Talmud were faced with a problem. Well, how do I know when the destruction of the second temple took place? I know when the destruction of the first temple took place. Well, I really don't know exactly. You remember, it's complicated. It was on this day, it was on that day, it was the 7th, it was the 10th. So we figured it out. We decided it's going to be on the 9th. But I have no biblical evidence for the second temple. So how do I know when it was destroyed? And I pointed out to you that the first answer is bad things happen on bad days. So when is it going to be? I don't know when it happened. Oh, must be. It happened on that day. It's a bad day. Why is it a bad day? Because a number of bad things happened. The first event of the five that I mentioned in the Mishnah that we saw in the second presentation is that the Jews were not allowed to enter into the land of Israel right away, and then was the destruction of the first temple. It's a bad day. So when you don't know when a bad event happens, you say it happens on a bad day. But here, we're taking the notion of subsuming to a much greater level. Here we're saying that even if we know it happened on a different day, we're still going to subsume it under the ninth of Av. It's not that, oh, we're going to say, well, it's probably happened then, or for sure it happened then. We know when it happened. And still we're going to say, we're going to take a 8 ER, 23 ER, one Sivan, three Sivan, and we're going to take it all and we're going to put it under the ninth of Av, and we're going to commemorate it not on the day where you just told me, or the set of dates where you just told me it happened. We're going to commemorate it on the ninth of Av. The catastrophe of the destruction of the temple was so huge and so overwhelming that it overshadows subsequent catastrophes, even one like the one wrought by the Crusaders, whose impact was deemed equivalent to the destruction of the temple. The ninth of Av is the date that is designated to remember and to commemorate all Jewish tragedies, whether they occurred on that date or not. Notice that this is just assumed. I'm repeatedly struck by the fact that there's no evidence that's adduced for this. There's no source that he brings for this. That's what we do. Again, the language is so powerful. The original is Ein Lehosif Moed Shever Vitaveira. Ein Lehosif, we don't add. Everybody knows that we don't add. It's so obvious that we don't add. And so therefore it's clear why we're doing it today on Tisha B'Av, on the ninth of Av, and we're not commemorating this and mourning for this on the day when we know that it occurred. No evidence is adduced, no support is deemed necessary, and that's just the way it is. I was so taken by this that I went and I checked seven manuscripts. There are seven manuscripts that we have of this elegy, and I checked them all in Jerusalem, in the Institute for Microfilm of Manuscripts. They all have this. Every single one of them has this line. And it also just so happens that this particular elegy enjoyed enormous prominence and is repeated and repeated century after century after century, included in the cluster of texts that are recited for posterity on the ninth of Av, on the day that we commemorate the temple. So powerful is the impulse to subsume under the ninth of Av that even events that we know did not occur on the ninth of Av get sucked into the power of the ninth of Av. This concept will be one fundamental crux that will come back in every single session for the rest of this lecture series. However, having made this point, and I think the point is powerful and extremely on target, it is clear that new fast days were established for the Crusades. We have endless evidence that fast days were established in Worms, in the city of Worms, on the 23rd of Iyar and the 1st of Sivan, and that a fast day was established in the city of Mainz on the 3rd day of Sivan to commemorate what happened to those communities during the time of the First Crusade. The earliest reference that we have to this is all the way back in the 13th century, and there are many references since. I want to bring you, in text number 6, one reference from the 18th century. I want to show you, I went looking for one of the latest references, and there are those, we have references even after the 18th century. But I want to show you that even into the end of the 17th and beginning of the 18th century, this is still going on. This text comes from a responsa written by Rabbi Jacob Reicher, who was one of the great rabbinic luminaries. He was born in around the year 1670. He died in 1733. And in 1715, he shows up as the chief rabbi of Worms. He's had a distinguished rabbinic career. Worms is still a very significant rabbinic placement. And he becomes a rabbi of Worms in 1715. And he writes the following. Now, I want to read this through with you and point out what will become very obvious, and that is that his issue is not historical. He's not writing to let me know that JJ needs to know when exactly what happened in the community for later historians. That's not his interest. He has a question of Jewish law that disturbs him, that he needs to address. And it just so happens that the only way to understand what the problem is, what we call halachically or legally or a Jewish law perspective, is to realize the whole story about the fast in Worms on the first day of the month of Sivan. Another word of introduction. The first day of the month is not a day to fast. We don't fast. Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the month, is sort of a quasi-holiday. We recite various passages from Psalms to celebrate. It's generally a celebration day. There's generally perceived of as a mutual exclusivity between fasting and celebrating the first day of the month. And yet, it's on the first day of the month that there is a fast day. I think the reason why we have so much evidence is precisely because it somehow undermined this general practice of not fasting on the first of the month. And so because they did, to commemorate that tragedy from 1096, it aroused all kinds of interest subsequently. So it made many more waves than we might otherwise, it might otherwise have made. But there was such a fast day. Here's the issue. This is the first opportunity that he has to experience this as a new rabbi in town. On the first day of the month of Sivan in 1716, which fell on a Friday, and now he's in Worms, on which it was the practice to fast here in Worms from the day of the decree, from 1096, from 1096. It's now 1716. I don't know exactly how long that is. It's a very long time. From 1096 to 1716, you do the math, you figure out exactly how many hundreds of years. It's a very long time that Jews in this city are fasting on the first of the month of Sivan. In 1716, they're fasting for something that happened in 1096. And what do? They fast until after midday on every first of Sivan. When it comes time to recite the early afternoon prayers, they recite the early afternoon prayers, and then they eat something, so as not to fast the entire day of the new moon when Jewish law prohibits fasting. So you have a problem. You can't fast the whole day. I mentioned to you earlier, fasting the first day of the month doesn't go together. But, oh my God, in 1096, this horrific disaster happened, so I'm going to establish a fast day. So I'm going to make a compromise. I'm going to fast part of the day. So how does it work itself out? I'm going to fast until the first opportunity I have to recite the afternoon service. I'll recite the afternoon service, and then I'm going to eat something, and then I'm going to recite the evening service. When the first of Sivan fell on a Friday, however, and that's the issue that he's now confronting, because now it's a Friday, it was their custom, parenthesis, since 1096, i.e. a long time, a very long time, it was the custom of this community that I just parachuted into, that I just joined, to say the afternoon and evening prayers immediately after the third hour, which means somewhere in the middle of the afternoon, and then to accept the Sabbath. In other words, they did not do what they normally did if it fell on another weekday, namely fast, afternoon prayer, eat, evening service. But they pushed off the afternoon prayer a little bit. Fast, afternoon, evening, then eat, and that was the Sabbath. And he finds this horrifically unacceptable. Because what had ended up happening was that they accepted the Sabbath way early. I mean, you can't accept the Sabbath Friday morning. There is a concept of adding to the arrival of the Sabbath. You don't wait till the last second. So you add a little bit, you add a little bit more, you add a little bit more. Especially in the summertime, the custom is in many communities to recite the evening service a little bit earlier. It's still daylight outside. But you can't recite it at 4 in the afternoon. There's a limit. And they were reciting the evening service for the Sabbath and accepting the Sabbath way too early. And they've been doing this forever. This is the issue that aroused his upset. When I saw this, I was very bewildered. They're saying the evening prayers at the wrong time. And I cried out against it like a bird, but they didn't listen to me. Here's the rabbi comes in and says, "What are you doing? I'm upset. You can't do this." And they say, "Rabbi, we've been doing this for 700 years. You know what? Get over it. It's not our problem. It's your problem." And he continues, "And I heard that earlier rabbis protested. To no avail." The rabbi thinks he has power in the community. Rabbi shows up, says, "Oh my God, you're doing something wrong. Rabbi, we love you. Welcome. This is the way it is." He didn't last very long. 2 years later, he was out of there and he became the rabbi in Metz. In 1718, he just couldn't handle this whole arrangement. I don't know exactly. I didn't ask him to what extent this particular interaction played a role in his deciding to leave. It wasn't that much longer. He's out. The issue that he's worried about is, oh my God, they're accepting the Sabbath too early. But meanwhile, as a historian, wow, what a gift. Now I know that in 1716, on the first day of the month of Sivan, in Worms, they're fasting. I know they didn't fast a whole day. That would be too problematic to fast a whole day on the first day of the month. But they're fasting. And if they're fasting, that's significant to me. On the one hand, no new fast days. On the other hand, fast days. But the answer, I believe, is very simple, and one to which we will also come back repeatedly. And that is that there's a very big difference between a national fast day and a local fast day. What did Kalonymus say? Why are we mentioning this on the 9th of Av? Why are we commemorating the Crusades on the 9th of Av? Because we are the Jewish people. As a Jewish people, nationally, collectively, we know, we just assume, it's pretty much obvious. Ein lehosif moed shever v'tavera. The Jewish people does not add days of commemoration. Everything is under the 9th of Av. Everything. Even if it didn't happen on that day, gets subsumed under that day. Commemoration is subsumable. It all becomes part of the 9th of Av. It is so overarching and so powerful, everything gets taken under it. But local fast days, yeah, we have local fast days. In Worms, they had a fast day in Worms. In Mainz, they had a fast day in Mainz. Local fast days, that did happen. The difference between a national fast day and a local fast day. We have seen that the legacy of the Crusades, or the aftermath of the Crusades, is that national fasts, no, i.e. Kalonymus, we don't add, that's why we do it on the 9th of Av. Local fasts, yes, Worms and Mainz. But did this distinction hold subsequently throughout the Middle Ages? Or do we see, parenthesis, and we will see, end parenthesis, attempts to establish even new national fast days? How strong was the impulse to subsume under the fast of the 9th of Av? Is the Kalonymus model replicable or not replicable? It is to this question that we will draw our attention beginning in my next presentation. Clearly, it's our fault. God loves us. God is doing whatever God does. God doesn't behave in any way differently than he used to behave. It's our fault. We're responsible. We're getting what we deserve.